the second intruder recites formally, as I topple slowly backward, chromatophores flaring and motor groups twitching. "We are committing this delightful reunion to memory, so that he may honour you with his personal attention. In fact, he has arranged a festive party for you, and we shall be on our way there just as soon as we have prepared you for a trip through the sewers. Regrettably, he cannot be here in person, but we assure you that he will savour this encounter." My skin crawls uncontrollably, as if 1,000 tiny spider-bots are running across it. "Come on, Flint! Stop poncing around and help me splice the cunt before she gets her fucking legs back!" The gravel-voiced shadow with the shock stick has me by the ankles and is wrapping something around them. Flint sighs. "As you will, Slate." I try to move my arms, but he's too fast, and the two of them flip me over on my face and pinion me. Some reflex I don't remember makes me try to tense my shoulders, but it's too little, too late. My servos aren't responding yet.
"I think she's coming round," Flint observes. "Deal with it."
I manage to open my mouth, ready to call for help, but Slate stings me in the back of the head with 50 kilovolts, and I stop noticing things for a while. It's dark. It's dark because my eyes are shut down. Duh. And I'm lying across something uncomfortable and hard. It's sticking in my back. And it's hot. I try to open my eyes, and they respond sluggishly, burning in their sockets. All I get is a faint impression of brightness. I'm temporarily blind, my retinas overloaded. My skin itches, every pore burnished to its smoothest shining finish. I must look a sight. I'm positively chromed. How gauche, I think vaguely. When I try to move, nothing happens. Then I realize that I'm not breathing. Gas exchange with my environment has ceased. How odd, I puzzle. That must mean panic. I try to scream that there's no air and I'm not equipped for vacuum. My electrosense is weak, designed for controlling home appliances rather than shouting across a noisy factory floor. But I'm beginning to work out where I am. They've tied me across a hard beam. It's under the small of my back, and my arms are immobilized beneath it. I try to pull my legs up, but they're tied to something else. I turn my face away from the heat, and I'm rewarded by a flickering shadow against the burning brightness in one eye. The light level seems to be dropping. For a moment, I was afraid they'd taken me out of the city and staked me out on the surface to fry. But that doesn't seem to be the plan. A festive party, they said. I listen, hard, hoping to hear some buzz or chatter of monitoring traffic. But there's nothing. On the other hand, I can feel a faint, grinding vibration through the small of my back, as if there's someone else on the beam, pole, rail, I'm lying across. And there's something else to cushion my head, something hard and flat. The white-hot glare is flickering faster now as my overloaded eye responds to the slight dimming. I blink, trying to reduce the amount of light entering my pupils, and I'm rewarded by a hazy eyelash-obscured view. I'm lying on a metal rail, one of a group of bars lying parallel to one another. My head casts a long shadow across the nearest one. I must be on the surface, and my head is turned away from the setting sun. The craggy edge of a crater looms to the left of the rails. To the right, there's a boulder-strewn plain. I tense and strain, testing my bonds. I know what they've done to me now, and it's not funny. Not in the slightest. I'm well rested. I'll still be alive when my nemesis inches into view, rumbling inexorably toward me on 1,000 wheels. The plinth my head rests on is part of the switchgear for swapping out undercarriage bogies. I try to sit up, but I only make it a few centimetres before I yank my hair painfully. The little thugs have tied it around one of the track ties. How long have I got, I wonder? Probably not long, a phantom memory answers. Cinnabar rolls at nearly 13 kilometres an hour, and the twilight zone isn't that wide. I prod for more details, but the echo is infuriatingly fuzzy and non-specific. It's probably a memory of Juliet's, but she isn't integrated enough for joined-up thinking yet. And she never will be, I realize. The wheels will crush my head and her soul chip like micrometeoroid debris, while stone sibs joke and watch my demise from an observation balcony on the prow of the city. It's getting darker. The heat beating on the back of my head is beginning to let up. What about the track repair gangs, I wonder? Surely they'll see me. But maybe not. Flint and Slate wouldn't have positioned me in front of a team of potential rescuers, would they? How long will it take Paris to realize I'm gone, I ask. Too long, says the icy cold echo that knows too much about this desolate wasteland. You don't want to rely on him anyway. All right, smarty pants, I think irritably. You get me out of this. Something moves in the knife-edge shadows near the tracks. I roll my eyes in its direction, trying to ignore the whiteout. Who are you? Stone's witness here to watch me die? I have a sudden intuition. Let me handle this, says a certainty bubbling up from the back of my head. I'm not sure whose memory it is, but she feels almost happy. I let go, and everything slides into place. I concentrate on my chromatophores, tweaking the ones opposite the solar inferno away from their default reflectivity. I can mess with my texture and color, tune my skin from pink goo softness to refraction grating scales. As a brief experiment, I roughen the skin on my wrists and grate at my bonds with denticles of silicon. But there's not enough freedom of movement to get anywhere. I'll never cut those ties in time. A shame, but Stone's vengeful sibs aren't that stupid. So I work on my skin texture some more. Refraction. What I'm about to try is fiddly work, and if I slip from the mirror finish too soon, I'll overheat badly, maybe cook myself. Diffract, diffract. Reddening my skin, roughening. The thing in the shadows moves, a curious rippling darkness against the penumbral background. I flex my back and try to turn my head farther, ignoring the tearing pain in my scalp. Help! I yell as loudly as I can, in electrospeak. I can feel the heat licking around the edges of my mirror-finished back, warming my face as the diffractive spines sprouting from my chromatophores bend the solar backlight around me. I must look like a black silhouette of a burning woman, surrounded by a ruby-red border. I tense and force my spines to lie flat. Then I tense the other way, sticking them upright. A flashing ruby-red border, that's what I want. The only color in this stark black and white landscape. Pay attention to me! The track hums beneath my cheek as I flare and fade, flare and fade. The barely visible thing snuffles around the sleeper ties, then turns toward me, and I have a nagging feeling that I've seen it before. It? Him. Help! I shriek, but all that comes out is a whisper. The track hums again as cinnabar, a saucer-shaped bowl beneath a crystal dome, rolls ponderously into view from behind the jagged gash in the crater's rim wall. The pale needles of 50 towers creep toward me on 1,000 steel wheels, grinding all to dust beneath their juggernaut tread. The track squeals and grates like a living thing. It's only a few kilometers away. The close horizon is deceptive. Help! I yell again. The thing in the shadows stands up and waggles its proboscis in my direction. It begins to walk, very deliberately, away from me. I flash my diffraction silhouette desperately, and it pauses for a moment, then rises on a puff of rocket-disturbed dust and zips away toward the onrolling city.
"Don't leave me here!"
I wail, overwhelmed by a sudden bleak stab of horror. For some reason, part of me expected that thing, whoever, whatever it is, to rescue me, and now that part of me feels betrayed. I can see what's going to happen, as if in a theatre of gore, the spectacle of my demise. Here I am, tied across three tracks, my head anchored to the northernmost one by my own hair. Here comes Cinnabar, squealing and grating along the tracks, on motors powered by the thermal expansion of red-hot metal just beyond the bright horizon. The moving mountain rolls toward me like an incarnation of doom, swallowing the world. First I'll see the overhanging lip of the city, then the guide wheel bogies to either side. Stone sibs have staked me out thoughtfully close to the center, where the great grinding power wheels drive the city forward at a stately 12.5 kilometers per hour. Somewhere high up, out of sight beyond the curve of the carrier deck, two evil dolls toast my demise with icy draughts of malice. I freeze for a minute as I imagine the shadows lengthening across me, then a brief glimpse of curved mirror-finished steel, then my head popping apart like a plastic fuel canister as knife-rimmed wheels slice off my feet at the ankles, crunch through my abdominal cavity. "Stop whining and pull yourself together," part of me warns grimly. The sunlight is already dimming. I can see stars smeared across the sky behind the city. You've got about 3 minutes of sunlight left, then 12 minutes until it's over. Which is more important, your hair or your life? My hair? I blink at the sudden realization. If my feet were free, I'd kick myself in the arse. I'm a fool. There may not be enough time. I have a full head of long ruby-red hair, one of my least unfashionable qualities. It grows from an array of extrusion follicles in my scalp and falls halfway down my back when I wear it loose. The Aristo assassins used my own braids to tie my head across the track. They've knotted them in two thick hanks under the rail. And I'm not strong enough to yank my own scalp off. But if I grow it... Well, yes. I force my scalp into activity, steeling myself against the crawling, chilly itch as I squeeze everything I can into extruding more hair, willing it to grow. I don't normally let my hair grow from day to day, but in a fashion emergency I can make 10 centimeters in an hour. It's physically draining, and it never looks as good, but it'll do at a pinch. Now, with panic driving my follicles into a frenzy, my glands pulse as I strain my neck muscles against my bonds. The hair grows white and fine as glass. As I pull on the still-setting fibers, they stretch, thinning to invisibility. Then they begin to snap. For the first couple of minutes, I'm not sure it's going to work, and wouldn't it be a crying shame to go to my death looking my worst for my enemy's imago? But then I discover I can nearly touch my chest with my chin. I stop squeezing my follicles, lean back until my head is touching the rail, then tense my shoulders and do my best to sit up. There's an awful tearing from my scalp, then sudden freedom. I pull my head away from my magnificent mane, leaving it wrapped around the rail, its roots thin to translucency. I'm as bald and ugly as any Mecca. I shiver in disgust at the picture I must make. Luckily, I'm the only mirror around here, except for the silent witnesses. A few minutes pass in shock and near exhaustion. The tracks hum and vibrate more urgently beneath my buttocks and ankles. I can tense my abdomen and pull myself nearly upright, but now I face a crueler fate. Bisection without extinction. There's no way I can regenerate from such damage unaided. They've shrink-wrapped my arms together behind my back with a sheet of industrial sealant and lashed it to the rail with a rope. I can flex my fingertips freely, but I can't get my nails in a position to cut through it, and it's far too tough to rip. Not even the silicone lube I sweat when I'm aroused would help.
You could chew your own arms off, one of my selves suggests dryly.
Her lack of ironic awareness frightens me almost as much as the suggestion.
They'd grow back.
I table the notion for future consideration if all else fails. What about my feet? I've been leaving my feet for last for no sensible reason, but now I blink. I've been stupid again, haven't I? I'm barefoot, of course. Heels retracted. Heels. I twist my feet together on point as I go to full extension. They creak and grate as I tense my tarsal stiffeners, feel extension cables shift position in seldom-used tunnels. It's not a position I use very often, for in full extension my heels are 15-centimeter spikes, and my toes barely touch the ground. It severely restricts my balance, and though some of my dead love's kind might find it erotic, I find it impractical. But in this situation, all I can do is stretch those toes. Stretch! I can feel my heels sliding out, narrowing, curling closer to the soles of my feet as the small bones rearrange themselves to support my weight entirely on the tips of my toes. I concentrate, trying to imagine myself in Paris's bed, trying to force myself to sweat, anything to lubricate this fatal passage. Is it my imagination, or is there some give in the bonds? If they lashed my ankles to the rail, they'll have assumed that my feet are wider from heel to toe. Pull! Stretch! But when I'm on point, my feet are half their normal length. My right foot slides free a fraction of a second before my left. I nearly knee myself in the eye. While I've been kinkifying my feet and getting creative in the hairstyle department, full dark has fallen across the tracks. I have to boost my eyes' sensitivity to see anything, and the grainy, ghostly starlight leeches fine detail from the view. The track thrums and starts to squeal as the vast bulk of cinnabar bears down on me. It looks huge, stretching halfway across the horizon, and scraping at the harsh sunlight overhead with the tips of its spires. I twist sideways, flailing my legs, as the volume of squealing and grinding rises and the track vibrates beneath me. Push! My arms twist painfully, and for a moment I have a vision of losing them beneath the cutting disc of a wheel. But something gives. My captors didn't expect me to get this far, and I managed to slide around so I'm lying lengthwise along the track, feet first toward the city. The rope tries to twist my arms half out of their sockets, but I dig my feet and my shoulders in and shove hard, throwing my whole weight sideways. The rope slips just as the shadow of the city's lower deck looms over me with a harsh grating rumble that I feel through the track. And then I'm lying on the too hot dirt beside the rail, arms tied behind me. I cower and duck my head toward my chest and give a last kick, curling away from the wrist restraint as the track begins to buck and sway and hiss like a malevolent spirit. The huge drive wheels roll over me like discs of darkness, and for an instant a giant tries to pull my arms off. I force myself to relax in the blackness, and then my shoulders stretch, and I sprawl forward in the hot dirt. I'm free. Centimeters behind me, the huge juggernaut wheels rumble past in procession, matched by the set on the opposite rail where my feet were tied. But my wrists are free now, the rope severed by their awful pressure. I lie between the tracks for almost a minute as the lead drive bogies thunder overhead. Then there's nothing overhead for tens of meters but the underside of the city, studded with hatches and access ports and ladders and ramps. and the load-bearing idler bogies on the outer rails. I stand up and stretch, retracting my heels most of the way but keeping my arches tight and springy. Then I turn and start to run after the drive bogey that so nearly chopped me into pieces. There'll be a ladder, I hope, and an access port. And then it'll be time to go looking for payback, one of myselves thinks coldly. I shudder. She seems to know what she's talking about. Gainful employment. There can be few sights more out of place in a luxury hotel than an angry bald ogress in a ripped black gown who storms in through the service entrance and demands to talk to the management, unless it is the front desk itself in a full-dress panic, sending remotes and drones rushing back and forth, locking down all its pipes and tubes and orifices, and going into an orgy of self-recrimination and hand-wringing apology. "Don't want an apology," I say breathlessly. "I want you to find where they came in and block it, and if you can hunt them down and crucify them as well." "My dear, I assure you that I will leave no crevice unexamined, no cranny unprobed. But what happened to your hair? Have you any idea who is behind this outrage? You poor thing." I allow myself to be cosseted and fussed over and whisked up to the bridal suite, once I'm assured it has been made safe, the entire floor sanitized and sealed. Then Paris hugs me tight and holds me, and effusively reassures me that I am safe in his heart. I almost permit myself to believe it, but as he undresses me with his remotes, and I lie down on his chaise, he confesses that he's afraid. "I know where they got in, but I've no idea why I didn't notice them. I've paid for external security to seal the opening, but it's absolutely horrible. Vermin!" He shivers beneath me. I stroke his intromissive adapter. "It's all right," I tell him. And this time he shivers for a different reason. "Let's not worry about that now." The last thing I need is a host who associates my presence with stress. "Hug me, dearest. I want you to touch me." It's manipulative, but by no means the worst thing I've done. I very deliberately make love to Paris, afloat in his bed of delirium, aware that with every passing second, my shadowy enemies have more time to realize that their fiendish plan has failed. I surface reinvigorated and slippery with sweat, my batteries recharged and my scalp covered with a frizz of thick red bristles just beginning to curl at the tips. The room has cooled around me, and the furnishings are detumescent and dulled after their hot, fleshy urgency. It smells faintly of salt and regrets. Paris has withdrawn his presence to afford me solitude, or perhaps he feels guilty about taking advantage of me. You can never tell with men. They have such a strange attitude to sex, almost as strange as creator females, but that's another story. I check my tablet. "I made some zombies," Paris tells me diffidently. "I hope you don't mind. 3 decoys in your shape. 2 of them were killed immediately. But the third is still wandering around. I think your assailants realize they have overreached themselves." He flashes me a disturbing montage of homunculi. "Do I really look like that, I wonder?" I have retained blue steel security for the comfort and safety of my guests, and they have offered to provide you with a chaperone for the duration of your stay. The second message is unsigned. "We understand Ichiban sent you. You have now had sufficient time to orient yourself. Please call at our offices at your earliest convenience. Address attached." And there is no third message. I check the elapsed time. Less than 10 hours have passed, barely sufficient to expect a reply from Emma. I sit at the dressing table, my mood sinking by the second. I came here at their expense. It's time to pay my part of the bargain. And find out what's going on, my suspicious selves remind me. I throw my requirements at the printer. Close-cut trousers and a hooded mesh top covered in thermal-absorbent padding, black rubbery spikes on the shoulders. Sexual accessibility down, defensiveness up. Once garbed, I resemble a skinny, shock-headed thug. Under the circumstances, that feels good. I dial up surface-protective mirror-finished goggles as well, glassy lenses to fuse with the skin around my eye sockets. If I must egress to the surface again, I shall be prepared. I'm sure Ichiban's friends are not interested in me for my deportment and musical skills. I make my way to the lobby unmolested, but encounter signs of Parisian paranoia everywhere, from freshly blocked power sockets and service hatches to a lumbering green-skinned monstrosity just inside the lobby door. It's 3 meters tall, 2 meters wide, has a gun turret for a head, and missile launchers along its spine. "Mistress Freya," it rumbles at me, keeping its muzzle politely tilted at the floor. "Management say am to accompany you. Please to confirm identity." I glance at the front desk. Paris is otherwise preoccupied with an irate patron, but has time to tip me a nod. "That's me," I say, and reach for the monstrosity's offered tentacle to exchange recognition keys. "Do you know what offices can be found at this address?" I ask, and pass Ichiban's friend's mail to him.
"Excuse, please."
The green giant hunkers down beside me, the floor creaks under his weight.
"I'm asking fire control."
"Yes."
"Is planetary branch office of Jeeves Corporation." "Fire control ask, do you want destroy it? Because..."
"No, no, that won't be necessary," I interrupt with all due haste. "But I need to go there. Do you know what they do? Or who they are? Can you escort me?"
"Not no. Not no. Yes."
I wait for more, but he's taciturn, a strong, silent type. I sigh, reflexively emoting. "What's your name?"
"Blunt."
"All right, Blunt. Can we go there, if it's safe? If not, can you protect me?"
"Yes."
Blunt pauses for a moment, then adds,
"If not self-protect, then fire control protect."
How reassuring. I blink up a street map and head for the door, but Blunt blocks me with an arm the size of a small crane.
"Blunt, go first."
He steps through the outer lock, turret head swiveling, then beckons me behind. I can feel his steps through the pavement, thudding like sledgehammers. Jeeves Corporation resides in an unfashionable medium-height tower on the edge of the current business district, in an area zoned for reconstruction. As we approach it, I see slave-chipped arbiter gangs at work. They're stripping out the fixtures from a skeletonized geodesic dome, scrabbling over the corpse of a great enterprise. The air here is under-oxygenated, hot, with the tang of silicone lubricant fractions. Blunt escorts me to the tower entrance, then pauses.
"We'll wait," he rumbles. "Not go in."
I look at the door. He'd never fit through it. "Well, thank you. If I'm not out of here in 15 minutes, or if you don't hear from me, call fire control and ask for backup. Can you do that?"
"Ma'am."
He turns to face away from the building, scanning the neighborhood with gunsight eyes. I go inside. The office block has obviously seen better times. Half the address plates behind the vacant front desk are blank, but it still takes me minutes to locate Jeeves Corporation. They occupy the sub-basement, sandwiched uneasily between Jordan Ballistics and the Travis T. Import Agency. I take the stairs three at a time, feeling positively mercurial as I kick off each step and drift down. The stairwell is dusty and drab, a third of the lighting panels dead of old age. Someone has gnawed on the tarnished brass handrail. I half expect to see a dead dustbuster in a corner, husk sucked dry by someone or other. Of course I have second thoughts about this meeting, but it's 5:30 I was off this planet. Jeeves Corporation looks like my best bet for a free ride to somewhere civilized. And so I make my way along the corridor until I come to a plain glass door. It's mirror-polished and clean, which is something, I think. I knock once, then enter. The occupant of the big chair behind the desk clears his throat. And my world turns upside down. I'm unsure what I was expecting, but it certainly wasn't this. My knees go weak for a confused moment as I apprehend that I am in the presence. But as he looks up from the pad he's reading and turns his avuncular gaze on me, the effect shatters. He smiles. "Good morning, my dear lady. How remarkable. You wouldn't be Freya 47 by some chance, would you?" "Good day," I stutter, trying to hide my confusion. For a moment it feels as if an EMP bomb has taken out my higher functions. He's perfect. But the partial pressure of oxygen is down around 1% and the temperature's over 70 Celsius. My true love's kind would be passed out on the floor, blue in the face and dying by the second. And if that isn't enough, I begin to take in the giveaway details. "Who are you?" "One is frequently called Jeeves. One may even answer to the name when it suits one." He smiles gnomically, and I take it all in, from his wrinkled pale pinkish skin and small eyes to his archaic, stiff-collared suit. He sits behind a desk patterned after the antique dendriform replicators called mahogany, in a den panelled and carpeted to resemble an ancient club or social institution of the Third British Empire period. If he was one of our creator's kind, he would be 50 years of age. The illusion is almost perfect. If the air conditioning was working properly, I could have mistaken him for... I could have... "Please be seated," he urges,